We in this country have seen many new faces, people from all parts of the British Commonwealth and Empire and from the Allied nations.
These are among the last pictures to be taken in the capital of the Gold Coast. For when this day is over, Accra becomes the capital of Ghana, an independent nation within the Commonwealth.
Hello everyone and welcome to Hello from Britain, the Black British History Podcast, a podcast focused on Black British women in the 20th century. My name is Sheon and we've got a special episode coming at you today with friend to the show, Simone. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here. Now everyone, Simone is an award-winning changemaker, campaigner and activist who has contributed to environmental, social and cultural work in Bristol, London and across the UK. She uses facilitated workshops to explore climate colonialism and examples of climate resistance and movements from the past and present day. And so, as you know, guys, I like to switch up the podcast every now and again. And I thought it would be great to have this interview with my good friend Simone about her work and about how her work is relevant to Black women in Britain. So again, thank you, Simone, so much for coming today. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you so much. I didn't even say hello to you. Hey, Sheon. thank you for having me on. Like, I'm super excited to be here. And yeah, as Shane said, she's one of my dearest mates. So this is like such an honor to be on one of the best podcasts I've heard.
Lol, you're such a liar. Anyway,
stop that. I'm not lying.
How are you anyway?
I'm well, thank you. It's been a good day. The sun is shining and I have just about wrapped up work. So I'm just really happy to chat to my mate for a bit. How are you doing?
I'm okay too. I'm happy to chat to my mate for a bit as well, because it feels like even though we have come out of a pandemic, I think we've come out of lockdown, it doesn't really feel that way. I don't know. I feel like we're still inside. I'm not sure how much has changed, but how about, tell you what is one thing you would like our audience to know about you? So when thinking about, okay, that episode that Simone was on, Simone is the person who does what? Like, what is one key thing that people must know?
Good question. My like interesting thing is not even to do with climate. I'm absolutely obsessed with porridge. And like, one day I'm going to make a career pivot to being a porridge content creator, because I just think it's brilliant. It's so good. And I like, ideally want to try porridge or the different variations of porridge from different countries and cultures all over the world, basically.
It hadn't even, my Western short-sightedness, I hadn't even realized there were other types of porridge. I remember, is Quaker oats a porridge?
Yeah, that's like, you know, rolled oats, but we've also got yam porridge. I think that's from Nigeria, right? There's Hausa cocoa from Ghana. There's like cornmeal porridge from like Jamaica. And I think like some other Caribbean islands eat it, but any form of porridge, I'm about it.
Wow. And it's sustainable as well, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Porridge is like, it gets you through the day. It's cheap. It's easy to make. It's just brilliant.
Wow, I mean, if that's not a ringing endorsement right there, I don't know what it is, folks.
There like, we go. Get my sponsorships.
Yeah, your Instagram, we're going to be seeing you, like Quaker oats, you're going to be up there every day with your live feed saying, guys, you've got to taste this, I really enjoy it. And you actually like it, you'll actually like endorse a brand that you like.
100%. How about you?
What's interesting about me? I like the colour pink. And I think maybe that's me internalizing the social construct of gender or whatever. I'm sure some academic or some psychologist might be able to analyze it. But I've always loved the color pink. I was looking at a picture of myself when I was 5 years old with like a pink braid in my hair the other day. And I got told off for it. But I've just always loved the color pink.
So I love that. I love that so much. And F your school for making you get in trouble for that pink hair. Yeah, you guys can't even see this, but Shane currently has pink headphones as well. And as long as I've known Shane, she's always had a pink outfit or pink hair or some sort of pink outfit. And it's literally her brand. And I love it.
It is my brand. In fact, so you'll be an influencer with porridge everywhere and I'll be an influencer with like pink borders around my pictures. It'll be part of my aesthetic. I think someone listening to this podcast might be a bit confused about what we're talking about. So can you break down what it is exactly you do? So you've created change when it comes to environmental, social, cultural work, but what does that mean? How would you describe to a layperson exactly what it is you do and how you've created change in that area?
So, good question. I work on climate justice campaigns. Like I do have a normal job. I don't know how to describe that. But I outside of that, I used to work on campaigns. And I worked in the divestment movement for a year. And basically, divestment, to break that down, is when you invest in something, you put your money into it. But when you divest from something, you're taking your money out of it. And the campaign is centered around universities and their direct investments in fossil fuel companies like Shell and BP. And basically, I worked with student societies and student groups on campus to campaign against their university to take that money out, because like a lot of universities like champion themselves on being quote unquote green and sustainable with like meat-free Mondays and loads of recycling bins on campus and loads of other great stuff. But you know, behind back doors and in their financial investments where it really matters, they're invested in these companies that not only cause the climate breakdown, but also cause like a lot of extraction and exploitation and violence, not only in the UK, but elsewhere. So it's like you can't label yourself as like green or progressive when your investments are entirely backwards. And like outside of that, also learning about like the history of climate change and like trying to understand its connections or similar story to like colonialism and how both of them are intrinsically linked, and bringing that to also youth groups and like societies at universities, basically young people, to kind of connect those histories. Because I think we kind of separate the two of like colonialism is on one side and like climate change and its histories on another, but both of them are interlinked because there was both extraction and exploitation of people and the land from colonialism times up until today. Does that
Right.
answer your question?
It does answer my question, but I'm thinking maybe we could rewind a bit more and ask two quick definition questions. So, Simone, could you explain to us what climate change means?
Yes. So climate change is the excessive warming of global temperatures on planet Earth. And this has been sped up by the anthropogenic, and by anthropogenic, I mean human-caused exploitation and heating of the planet. So that's kind of the basic definition. And then when we think about climate change even further and the kind of human impact on speeding up this change, we then get to think about which people and which countries have been doing that. So climate change is not, it's not on equal footing. Those kind of wealthier and white nations of the global north, for example, are they bear the most responsibility for climate change. So countries like Britain, France, the US, Saudi Arabia, Australia have some of the highest carbon and greenhouse gas footprints as compared to other countries, for example, in South sub-Saharan Africa, who have a footprint less than zero. So it is very unequal in who is causing climate change as well.
And then another definition I think might be key for us to understand what we're going to talk about in today's podcast is climate justice. What does climate justice mean?
Good question. So climate justice to me is like the recognition of like our interdependence and interconnectedness of the world. So like our hu the human, the non-human, the land, ancestral knowledge and practices, like the weather, the seasons, everything is connected. Climate justice is in fact the liberation of all oppressive si systems which seek to exploit and control and categorize the people, the land, and its resources, particularly Black, Indigenous people of color. And climate change focuses on the root causes of climate change, making systemic changes that require us to address the unequal burdens to our communities and realign our economy with our natural systems and not profit. But essentially, to kind of really like narrow down what climate change is as well, like as a movement and like just as kind of a way to live by, like climate justice is a is about working from the grassroots up to create solutions to our climate, social, and energy problems to ensure the right of all people to live and learn and work and play and pray in safe, healthy, and clean environments. And I think if we view climate justice in that way, that everyone should have the very basic of those things, we will begin to see the intersections of who does and who doesn't have these things. And like all of these are markers for who is in closer proximity to social and environmental degradation and those who are not. And like, we find those that are nearest to like social and environmental degradation have compounding markers being flagged. So it means that many of their needs are not being met under this system.
Thank you. That's very, very helpful. Why is this something that you're interested in? Like, where did this come from? Where did this need to create change in this area come from?
So I think I've always been someone that's been really interested in like the world and like the physical world, I guess. Like when I was young, like my favorite subject was geography. So shout out all the Black geographers and also the actual CIC Black geographers, because they're great. And like geography is the study of like humans and the land, and how like the land impacts humans and how humans impact the land. I'm saying it in quite like a basic way, but essentially it looks at all relationships that are on earth, and like how any change brings a change elsewhere. And like in those lessons we used to learn about like, you know, how, you know, volcanoes would affect people or earthquakes, and also their ability to cope with such things. And what really struck me about that initially, so this was around like age, I don't know, 14 when I was in school, is how some countries were able to cope better with these climate disasters than others. And like more often than not, those countries were considered like more economically developed countries, and then the ones that couldn't cope as well were less economically developed countries. The only thing that it didn't really go into at that time was why certain countries were more economically developed and why some of them were less. And a lot of the less economically developed were in like countries in Africa, the Caribbean, Asia, and South America. And some of the more economically developed ones were mostly like America, Europe, the UK, Australia. And what we kind of see there is that these are also the countries learning from this that participated in slavery or encouraged the exploitation and kind of domination of people and the land for profit. And like, I think that's something that I didn't quite learn until later on. But it's very interesting to see how that history is missed out of like our secondary and younger schooling education. So that was like my first interest. And then after that, when I was like 17, I got an internship at the City of London Corporation. And by the City of London, I mean the Square Mile. The City of London actually doesn't have a council, but the corporation essentially acted like its council. So it had like an air pollution unit, and that is where I worked. And I used to walk around with my intern friend, basically measuring these little, collecting these little air pollution tubes. And then we bring it back to the office and analyze them and like create these graphs to see how air pollution is. I will tell you now, the Square Mile is so polluted. It has levels of like nitrous oxide and carbon dioxide, which are quite bad for like the lungs and the cardiovascular system. It has levels above the recommended limit every day. But what struck me more was that like the City of London actually has loads of cars going through it, so it makes a lot of sense. But what didn't make sense was the area surrounding it had a lot less traffic in them, yet had higher levels of air pollution. And these areas had disproportionate amounts of like Black and people of color who were working class. And like an example of that is like Tower Hamlets as a borough is right in the City of London and just a bit outside of it. And it's like they had some of the worst levels of air pollution that we've ever seen. But also looking at like the other aspects of it, they have like the highest levels of like breathlessness and asthma, the lowest sort of access to healthcare and hospitals. So then it becomes a compounding image of how there's several needs not being met in these communities. And like looking at Tower Hamlets and other boroughs with high populations of working class people of color, we found the same story. And that kind of inspired me or kind of spurred me on to think more about how air quality and climate change isn't just an issue in itself. It's not a vacuum issue. It's constituted by so many other aspects, such as race and class, which I looked at specifically, but other things play into account, like gender and disability and all sorts.
And so from what you're saying then, would it be safe to say that your work is focused on climate justice?
Definitely. Like, I think climate justice speaks more to like the work that I want to do, because climate justice encompasses like getting rid of all of these oppressive systems that not only kind of oppress us in an environmental way, but also in a social way. And I definitely like to frame the climate crisis as both a social and environmental one. And like, they can't be pulled from each other, because it's the people that are experiencing these environmental consequences. And it's also certain kinds of people that are inflicting this damage onto the environment as well.
And it's interesting, I think, how you've talked about, even though you didn't get the sort of education you're looking for until you were older, that from a young age, you've been thinking about issues like colonialism, people of colour, people in the developing world. And so, again, I want to ask you, where does this come from? Does it link to your own personal identity or anything like that? Because what if somebody listening to this podcast is just like, you know what, mate, why do you care about all of these other people?
Such a good question. My heritage is I'm Ghanaian, or like British Ghanaian. And I think from a young age, my parents were first generation migrants, and I am a second generation migrant, if that makes sense. And they were very keen. My mom was also, she did geography at university. So also, it looks like I'm following a family tie of being a geographer. I hope my kids do geography too. But basically, she was very keen to let me know about Ghana's history, especially Ghana's history as being the first African nation in sub-Saharan Africa to gain its independence with our president Kwame Nkrumah. And yeah, she spoke about colonialism a lot and how it wreaked havoc not only in Ghana but across Africa, and that Britain actually colonized Ghana, and it colonized a lot of Africa and other places in the world. She kind of spoke about how, you know, Ghana and many of these colonized countries have been exploited and robbed in order to propel the kind of economic and cultural and scientific progression of these colonial powers. And so and she obviously didn't explain it to me in that way, but she kind of spoke about how these countries are labeled in these ways of like less economically developed and more economically developed because there has been a transaction or an extraction that has taken place, which has left some countries completely exploited and left other countries in absolute gain of this wealth that they've stolen. So it's always been something that's been in my family and in my mind. And like, interestingly enough, I'm quite close to my grandfather, and he actually lived before Ghana got its independence. So he actually lived in Ghana when it was called Gold Coast, which is absolutely mad because my granddad only just turned 90, and Ghana is in fact like 63 years old as we know it. So it's very interesting to hear from him how Ghana used to operate and how things sort of changed when we got our independence, and Kwame Nkrumah was essentially trying to bring a new country to life and like figure out how we do like our national health and our roads and our schools. Whereas, you know, other countries like the UK have never, they've had years, decades, centuries to actually figure out who they are as a country and how they operate. Whereas these countries that have just gotten their independence and aren't even 100 years old are literally, they're doing it from scratch and doing it from a place where they've even been robbed of resources and people. Like, it's a lot of our like kind of organizers and activists have been kind of disappeared or exiled or killed or any of these things. So it's just really interesting to see how countries have built themselves up after decolonization sort of happened. I've gone on a massive tangent, but that is my story. That is the life.
No, but it's a useful tangent that we've gone on, because even like, not for nothing, whenever people say, you know, empire is such a long time ago, I just think, you know, my dad is older than independent Nigeria. My dad was born a British subject and I'm only in my early 20s. So it's very recent history. And linking to your family history, because on this podcast, we tend to talk about African and Caribbean migrants to Britain and their experiences in Britain. I wonder if you know what brought your family to Britain in the first place, and whether your grandfather actually ever lived or worked or studied in Britain and sort of went back and forth. And I ask that because going through the archives as I have, I've seen that actually many West Africans have been in Britain for a fairly long time as students, which is interesting. So the prevailing narrative of West Africans is that we only came in like the 80s and 90s, but actually in the early 20th century, a lot of West Africans came as students, came to the UK for a bit and then went back. And I sort of was wondering more about your family's migration experience in the UK, going back however many generations.
Good question. I really love how deep we're getting into our family histories. I've never spoken about this on like in anywhere, I think, apart from conversations with you, Shane. But my family history is, my granddad actually stayed in Ghana until he was about 50. What I do know is he came to the UK in the 70s, and it wasn't actually to study, it was to work. But his younger brother, basically my granddad was one of the oldest siblings, and they couldn't actually afford for him to go to school here, and he didn't get onto the kind of scholarships that were being kind of given to like African subjects at the time. So he came to work and then he was able to get a house and he paid for my grandma to then join him about 5 years later. But his brother had actually been to the UK before he even left. So his brother had come and I think in like 1965 and went there for university and sort of went back and forth for a long time. And they were a lot richer as a family by the time his younger brother was able to go. So it just kind of meant there was more money to play around with for him to go back and forth. And he also studied engineering, which was, it's still a high paying job, but it was very high paying at the time. So it meant he had his own money to come back and forth. And then going from that, my grandparents settled in the UK from about the mid-1970s and have been here ever since, but now go back very frequently. My dad actually, he came to Britain in the 80s and he in fact came here on a student scholarship. He studied biomedical science at King's University, got a degree, and then he worked in a lab for a bit and then it actually wasn't paying a lot, so he got another job. But that was the reason he came. And then he worked super hard doing all of these odd jobs, as a lot of migrant parents do, from like doing labs in the day to cleaning at night and all sorts of things. And then he paid for my mom to join him about 2 years later, and then they've been here since then. And then they obviously had my oldest brother in 1992, and from then they had the rest of us, and that's our story.
So when you're talking about your grandparents, are you talking about your mum's parents or your dad's parents?
I'm talking about my mum's parents. That's a good question. My dad's mum, sadly, my dad's dad passed like 40 years before I was born. So I've never actually met him. But my dad's mum, she actually came to the UK for the first time, not for schooling. I think she came in the 80s herself, but it was to work as well. I think she came towards the end of it. So like 1989, for example. And then she worked around for a bit and then she actually moved to America because my dad's sister lives in America. And what she wanted was to get an American visa over a British one, which I have no idea why. But she went there and lived there for a long time and then kind of skirted between Britain, Ghana and America.
You know, what I'm hearing in a lot of your answers is just, it's making me reflect on how international our experience truly is, I think. Mm-hmm. Being from an ethnic minority in the UK means that your identity is inherently international, because already we're talking about family members of ours going back only a few generations, coming from Ghana to the UK to America, all these different flight paths or maybe boat paths in our family history very, very recently. And so with that, in the fight for climate justice or for change when it comes to the environment, should we be looking to make more international connections to help further change?
Definitely. Looking at like climate justice from like an international lens, some of the most like violent and largest extractions have happened elsewhere. And I think sometimes what we kind of see here in the UK is like climate change and pollution is dire, especially for Black people, but it almost feels like something that's removed from like the more immediate issues like poverty, which is very true. It's immediate, or other kind of lacks in our communities and needs that need to be met, like healthcare or like youth provision or mental health provision, those kind of things. But like elsewhere, and I feel like that's, we also feel quite turned off or like shielded from those issues because it happens elsewhere, right? So like even Britain as itself, for example, is like, yeah, you know, like we weren't really interested, or like we weren't really involved in the slave trade like that because we didn't actually have any slaves here like picking our produce. And like there was, the site of violence wasn't necessarily here, it was done elsewhere in like the Caribbean and Africa or Western Africa and North America. So it's like it was easy for Britain to separate itself from that violence, and I think it's a similar thing done to Black people elsewhere. And how we experience climate change here in the UK, the majority of Black populations in continents like Africa and the Caribbean and South America are facing not only the extraction, but the violence that comes with it. So like when climate activists there are trying to kind of defend their land and defend their resources, they're often met by like state police and state military that are actively trying to oppress their fight. And then you come across or get up against these private corporations that are global corporations like Shell or like Barclays or BP, and they win every time with their extraction. And oftentimes their extraction pipelines are never up to the same quality as the ones they'd use in the global north. And it just means that, like, we're in closer proximity to kind of harm from these toxic chemicals that are being released. Also the extraction and the kind of aftermath that comes with that, like, you know, polluted waterways or land that can no longer be like farmed and irrigated with. And it's like, often these extraction companies and banks and insurance companies financing this climate degradation are in fact British or like previous colonial powers, such as like Shell is Dutch, you know. And so like it models the same kind of colonial methods of extraction and exploitation and wealth creation for wealthy global north nations off the backs of Black people and their land elsewhere. And I think like keeping an internationalist lens keeps us in check about like climate justice isn't just relevant to us in the UK because of how we're affected, but also about thinking about how it affects Black people worldwide. And in order to kind of reach this global liberation or this Black liberation, it has to be internationalist. There's never been a time where we've won any battle, like from decolonization, ending the South African apartheid. It's always been with an internationalist lens. So we can't only just look to the UK for our liberation, because quite frankly as well, like, the UK is quite late to this party. There's been like Black and Indigenous people worldwide resisting climate change for centuries. So in fact it's our kind of responsibility and our right to kind of make sure that we're on the right side of history and like fighting with them and showing solidarity in like practical and meaningful ways as well.
I completely agree with what you said about how a lot of struggles for Black liberation have been internationalist, even thinking back from the days of transatlantic slavery, right, up to things that we talked about on this podcast last month when it comes to the Race Relations Act. We've got a comprehensive Race Relations Act in this country, the United Kingdom, on the back of American influences and particularly Martin Luther King Jr. So I think it's very, very important what you're saying about internationalism. But beyond that, it seems that you're saying that colonialism is linked to many of the issues that we face when it comes to climate justice today. Have I got that right?
Yes, correct.
And so do you think then it's important for activists, whether it is Extinction Rebellion or Greenpeace or Amnesty or anyone else who's not involved in a big organization, but who thinks that the fight for climate justice is important, do you think that they need to reckon with colonialism and its impacts as well?
100%. I think slowly now, and that's due to the work of like absolutely tireless and like formidable Black and like people of color, like activists that not only work in those spaces but work outside of that in a grassroots level, in a policy level, like all sorts all over the place, have drastically pushed for like a racial lens and like a kind of colonial history to be owned up to in these large NGOs, I guess, that are doing this work on like a larger level or like a global level. Definitely, like, I think it's important to frame the struggle within like 500 years. Like, the climate crisis is deliberate and like highlights the crisis point of hundreds of years of like colonialism and dominance and exploitation of like Indigenous people of color and the planet. And like the current framing that we see in like very mainstream NGOs like Greenpeace and Amnesty and Friends of the Earth, like, is that, you know, it's posed as a new crisis when in fact like the destruction of people, land and ecosystems and livelihoods is not a new or recent fight, but something that continues today. And like Black and Indigenous people worldwide have been fighting to protect their land and their water and their cultural practices, their farming practices and just general way of life against colonial powers for all of this time. And it's important that these large NGOs and ourselves as individuals recognize that fight, because like when we fight for climate justice, we're continuing this fight for them in the pursuit of liberation for us all. And we can't reach a point of climate justice in today's context without recognizing what its history is, and that history is completely rooted in colonialism and exploitation. And if we don't understand that, like, countries who are experiencing the sharpest consequences of climate change are in the predicaments that they are in because of that colonial history, then we'll never be able to move forward with climate solutions that first of all center that history, also place reparations on that history, and then move forward to what an equitable world would actually look like.
So can you give us a couple of examples of that history then? Because you've touched on a few times about how Indigenous people, Black people, people of colour have fought for climate justice over the centuries. Do you have any examples that come to mind?
I do. I actually have a couple. So I will speak about either one or two or three, who knows? And then we'll go from there. But my first example is around sugarcane and sugar and the monocrop industry that the slave trade sort of encouraged for very quick and rapid profit. And the sugarcane industry had such an adverse impact on the environment as the industry sort of grew in Caribbean countries. And it kind of went in succession. So first of all, it was sort of in the Dominican Republic in the 16th century, and then the Lesser Antilles. So that's I think Dominica and Martinique and those areas in the 17th century. Then we get to Jamaica and Haiti in the 18th century, which is documented about a lot. And then we kind of actually come to Cuba and Puerto Rico in the 19th century. And Cuba's sugar plantations continued well into the 80s. I think Castro was still fighting against sugar plantations and the ownership of land at that time. So it's still a very, for how, Castro's time was the 80s. And that's very recent as compared to the colonial times. But the kind of destruction of forest and the loss of fertility and erosion of soils was a big, big marker of the destruction caused by the slave trade and that consistent use of the land. And it's really interesting because in comparison to indigenous practice, so both people indigenous to the lands of the Caribbean and those indigenous to the lands of North America, they had very specific farming practices that honored the land and honored the fact that the land feeds you. So there's no reason for you to exploit it unsustainably because you need it for your own longevity, and the land should thrive without you, essentially. And so they included things crop turnovers and leaving the land to kind of, recoup itself. Whereas in comparison, during the slave trade, the land was consistently used. There was never any break. It was just let's use this land for as much as we can, as quickly as we can to generate the profit we need to, create the wealth that we want. And so it means that when you look at the lands across the Caribbean, but specifically in Jamaica, for example, there are areas of that land that are permanently scarred. And it's interesting that colonialism and climate change are considered such separate histories when the literal scars of colonialism are in the land. From today, there are lands in Jamaica, for example, that do not grow the same as the lands on higher plains because the land has been exploited so much that the grass can't grow above shrubland level as compared to the trees that grow in the mountainous areas. So we can see that direct consequence of that. And another thing about sugar as well is that 1 acre of sugar kind of it needed about 1.5 tons of manure, which is so much. And reading through the kind of colonial archives online, this was also a job that slaves absolutely hated. So you can see the kind of violence that was inflicted on both the land and the slaves to create this profit that they will never see of. And this manure would kind of leach into the waterways that slaves would drink from and use to cook and use to bath, which caused extreme outbreaks of diphtheria and cholera and just general diarrhea in the slave populations. And considering how closely they lived and stayed together, this would lead to death in many of the slave populations. And again, what that would mean is when many of the slaves died, they would just go back to Africa and see how many more people they could steal and enslave and send over to the Caribbean to continue to work as enslaved people. And then another example as well is the change in ecology. That's like the first examples considering both, the human and physical impacts, but focusing specifically on the physical environment, it was permanently changed by colonialism as well. And there's a kind of academic called Sean F. Britt who talks about this in a paper called Fueling the Fire, Examining Caribbean Colonial Relations Between Humans and the Environment. And he sort of speaks about how the intense European colonization and the establishment of the plantation system across the island compromised its ecology and its environment. And he talks about colonial powers. So I think Britain colonized, and they introduced this tree called the Campeche tree, and it's a very beautiful tree endemic to Europe initially. And basically, it was an alien species. And what it did was it brought over disease that it could obviously deal with, but the plants native to Nevis couldn't. And it was also fighting with these native plants for resources like water and sunlight and just space. And what happened with that is that it actually led to the extinction of a native species called the mastic evergreen shrub. And that shrub hasn't grown back since the 1700s, which is absolutely wild. And it doesn't just go off of like the flora and like that ecology, but we also have to think about the animals and the organisms that would have fed on this, and that would cause them to die out also. And like thinking about like freed slaves as well, like this change to like the landscape and the animals and the kind of plants that they could use no longer existed. So they couldn't hunt for the same sort of like food native to the land. And it's just really interesting to kind of see how the landscape and like flowers, plants, animals have been changed in the Caribbean. And like, what would the Caribbean landscape look like had it not been colonized and intensely exploited? I've got one more example, but I wanted to pause and ask if you had like any thoughts on what's been said, actually.
Your examples, Simone, that you just brought up are really, really interesting, because it actually made me think of, and maybe, I don't know, maybe listeners, you're getting a sense of how my brain jumps around quite a bit, but made me think of the space race that we're having at the moment. Mm-hmm. The private space race we're having between Elon Musk, Jeff Bezos and Richard Branson. And it made me think of that, because it seems that, so I think Jeff Bezos is quoted somewhere saying that he hopes that 3 trillion people can live in space someday. And I wonder, as we begin to settle places outside of Earth, as we begin to colonize perhaps the moon even, and introduce new species and start planting trees on the moon and start introducing new organisms and stuff like that, do you think that if we do come to move outside of this earth, if our grandchildren or our great grandchildren are listening to this, like the people in Xenon 21st Century Girl on some space station somewhere, what lessons do you think we can learn from what you just talked about changing ecology and colonialism when it comes to our future potential life in space and colonizing space? Do you have any views on that at all?
I have a few views. I think it's all wild that they're trying to ditch everyone who can't afford to be there to burn in the climate change and destruction that they've caused. So that's my first like reflection. It's wild. The second reflection is like, we haven't even sorted out the exploitation and colonialism and the history of that here. So it's like, how in the heck are they going to go there and kind of build this quote unquote utopia and essentially start again without actually having the tools to not exploit and extract? Like, that's all they know. And it's like the fact that you've gone to, no, but the moon didn't actually ask you to be there. It didn't ask to be colonized. But it's like it's ingrained in these people that they need to own and exploit things. And it's like, no, you need to allow these planets, I can't believe I'm saying allow these planets agency, but yes, allow these planets and the land and the people agency. And that's kind of what colonialism and exploitation under capitalism does. It removes that agency from people and the land to not kind of live for themselves and sustain themselves. Rather, they're owned and just exploited by the power that is essentially causing all of this dominance and violence on them. And yeah, I just think it's nonsense. I'm not gonna lie. And it's like billionaires of all people don't know anything about sustainability. So it's like, how in the heck do you think this is going to sustainably last? And even linking that to the colonialism that happened here, even with the like large crops like sugar and cotton and indigo and tobacco, indigenous scholars and farmers and activists have spoken about how their ways of living and ways of farming meant that they were allowed to, they existed on those lands for millennia, like thousands of years. And the land that they used was always the same land. Like, they were able to sustain it and maintain it. So it lived itself, it had the agency to sustain itself as well as sustain them. And it's like millions of years of development of that kind of fertile soil was eroded away in roughly 100 years because of the sheer zeal, for lack of a better word, the sheer amount of like times that land was used and exploited. In just 100 years, all of those lands became unable to use again. So it's like, if we think about that and how quickly those millions of years were erased, within 100 years, who knows, the moon is already uninhabitable, but it will become way worse once those billionaires are done with it.
But then to push back on that though, did you never watch that film Xenon 21st Century Girl with Raven Simone living on the space station and they were listening to holograms and stuff? That doesn't that seem like fun?
That is so funny. I did watch that film and I love that. And I also love Raven Simone. But I don't think it's possible. I just don't think it's possible. Like, why do we need to be there? Do you know what I mean? Like, there's so many things to sort out here, such as the absolute imbalance in wealth or the fact that people don't have access. Like, Richard Branson is from the UK. And like, not to say that the UK is the absolute marker for poverty in any kind of word, or any sense actually, but the UK actually faces its own level of poverty. Like, there's food poverty, there's like housing poverty, people don't have homes, people don't have access to healthcare, people don't even have access to jobs that maintain their workers' rights. Like, there are so many people that are on the lines of being exploited a lot quicker, or like without any support. There's more people on the lines of like having access to their very, very basic needs to live. And it's like, you, Richard Branson, for example, who's the person from the UK, those are things you can sort out here with your billions of pounds, and you haven't sorted them out. And it's like, you're going to the moon to do what exactly? And that also, not just the UK, but like billionaires could essentially like end a lot of the kind of world poverty that we see, and they don't do that. So it's like, I don't actually know what your motive is for going to the moon other than taking your money elsewhere because you can afford it and because you can do it, and just leaving people behind in this climate and social breakdown to kind of fend for themselves. Like, it, to me, it just feels like, and I've seen people kind of describe it on Twitter as like I don't even know what to call it, like a dick race, like a race to the moon between like three men that just want to flaunt all their money and flaunt all their resource. And that's what it feels like to me. Yeah,
I think I was listening to a podcast the other day where it just seems, well, somebody said that it seems to be a race for the first person to get a selfie on the moon, maybe to put on Instagram. We'll see influencers go in first class.
Literally, like, it's all so unnecessary. And it's like, again, like, they're never going to offer us like a trip to the moon, are they? Like, us everyday folks, is you're just going to watch them on TV or Instagram or the selfie they finally post after day 46 of being in the sky. And it's like, what does that actually serve for everyday people? And the majority of the world's population are in fact everyday people, or like, they're working class. So it's like, what's the material impacts of you doing that for us or anyone?
You know, I think your response is interesting, because I think there's a lot to unpack there, because you've talked about billionaires and you've talked about capitalism. And I was wondering, because I know many, many people have different views on capitalism, many, many have different views on whether billionaires should exist. So I wonder, how do you view capitalism with relation to climate justice? And then how do you view the role of billionaires within that? Do you think that capitalism has inherently made the world a less equal place, a world where we've got a lot of climate injustice? Or do you think that things are much more complicated than that?
Oh, good question.
Or is that too big a question?
It's a big question, but I do think that capitalism... I know, like, capitalism can very much feel like a catch-all for a lot of the problems of the world. Like, I don't know, someone says, oh, like, we don't have homes, and then someone is like, capitalism is the response. And like, I know for people that feels like it can't all be capitalism, but genuinely it is. And like, I think capitalism as a system has basically allowed for everything to be up for grabs, and it can be unsustainably used and exploited. And once it's owned privately, that person can do essentially what they want with it, and that often leads to that kind of unsustainable extraction and exploitation of like the land or the people, whatever it is. And like, in regards to like climate change, it has meant that like the world and its resources have essentially become commodities. Like, water has become a commodity, energy has become a commodity, as well as the land in itself, and like trees, and like, yeah, the land essentially. And what that has meant is that these private companies are allowed, essentially, once they have all of this capital, to go into places and set up their extraction rigs for fossil fuels. And because they've paid off the government and like the police and the kind of military and other arms of the state, it means that they have free reign to kind of extract in the ways that they can. And like, it also means that they're able to displace communities around there. So like, an example is the Cerrejón mine in Colombia. The community that lived there were like the Wayuu people, and they are mostly Black Indigenous Colombians, and they've essentially been displaced because it's BHP actually that like runs that mine. BHP is in fact a mining company, and they mine for coal in the Cerrejón mine in Colombia, and they are an Anglo-Australian multinational mining company. And because they've bought that land and like paid off everyone because they're a private business, it has meant that they were very easily able to displace the Wayuu people from their homes that they've lived in for like thousands of years, and like with no compensation. And it's like that is done all across the globe, and like who kind of faces the brunt of that? It's mostly people of color across the globe, women, disabled folks, and it's just awful. And I think because of capitalism, extraction of fossil fuels has become so profitable that there's almost no means to its end until there's literally nothing else to extract. And capitalism allows for that unsustainable extraction until literally nothing is left. And even when there's nothing left, they'll find a new way to exploit the land further. So, for example, we see with fracking is not necessarily, and fracking basically is like going into deep into the earth's mantle and like extracting the, it's not, it's like the class B oil for lack of a better word. So you know that you extract oil, crude oil, and that's like premium oil. It gives you like a lot of energy for what it's worth, hence why it's so expensive. But fracking extracts the kind of dredges of that oil, and because it's like the dredges, it kind of gives almost around like 50% of the energy that crude oil would give. So it's not actually the best practice, and it takes about the same amount of energy and money to extract. And it's like that isn't a viable option, neither for making profits or energy, yet they still don't want to invest in kind of greener technologies, because essentially those technologies would become kind of self-paying and they wouldn't create as much profit as extracting this kind of dredge B crude oil to kind of sell off to other people or other energy companies. So you can see again that like there's never, people and like the land are never put in front of profits, and that's what capitalism has allowed for. And like thinking about capitalism, the land and slavery, when we think about capitalism, that was, slavery was firstly an economic endeavor. It was like, how are we going to make the most money through exploitation and extraction? And in order for that to happen, they needed people that would work for free, that would be slaves. And who was going to be that slave? So they had to kind of denote people, particularly Black people and people of color, as racially inferior in order for them to be denoted as the people that should work for free or essentially should be slaves. So when we combine like racism with capitalism, we get racial capitalism, and that is the way that, yeah, like Black people or people of color have been essentially dehumanized and denoted in order to fuel the progression of white people, like whiteness, the global north. So it's like, capitalism can't be kind of taken away from like what we see from climate change, both historically and in present day, as well as like colonial histories and what we see of that and what we see of racism in the present day. It all kind of meshes together to create all of these awful consequences for people and the land.
But would things get better if we moved away from capitalism, though? Because I know many people within activist spaces say that capitalism is bad. But, you know, we've also seen that, you know, communism hasn't worked well historically, neither has socialism. I mean, we both come from a continent where many of the leaders upon independence said that they're going to be pushing forward socialism, and that really hasn't worked out well. What is the solution here?
A really, really good question. What I will say of like communism and socialism is that I think like sitting in the context of a capitalist society, which, or capitalist global society, which was kind of embedded from like the 1500s, I think both socialism and communism didn't necessarily get the chance that they did to thrive in the way capitalism did, because they're both antithesis to what capitalism is. So even though like people say those things didn't work, and you know, in some cases they did not, we also have to look at the fact that they were essentially like sabotaged in so many ways in order for them to not work and for capitalism to continue in the way that it does. So like many of these socialist leaders were in fact killed or sabotaged by their own sort of like cabinets who had more allegiance to their colonial powers for like either money purposes or power purposes or both or many other things. We've also seen other bodies, surveillance bodies like the CIA, actively like follow these people around, try to kill them, try to spy on their moves, try to sabotage their moves. That happened in Ghana, that happened in the civil rights movement, that happened in Cuba, like everywhere. So it's like, I don't think there's enough kind of standing to say that those things didn't necessarily work when they didn't actually get the footing that they should have to work. And even in the times that they did exist, so I guess like a socialist Ghana, the amount that they achieved despite the kind of capitalist kind of powers sabotaging them at every point showed us that a different world is possible. Like, there is a world out there where the majority of people have a high literacy rate, the majority of people can access healthcare at either for free or very cheaply, the majority of people should be able to go to school, the majority of people should have access to transport and roads, the majority or all people should like value the work that women do and value the kind of farming practices and being able to like sustain yourself and grow your own food. All of those things are like rights that people should have, as well as like housing / shelter. So I think, like, I've gone on a tangent a little bit, but essentially I think socialism and capitalism show us that these are rights that we should have, and it's possible. It just depends on the wealth distribution, because like at the moment capitalism allows for wealth to just sit with the capitalists, and those are essentially the elites of society. Our billionaires are kind of like monarchs, our politicians, some of them business owners, especially of global corporations, and the wealth isn't actually distributed to everyday people who do the majority of the work to make these people rich. Whereas if we inverse that and like the power is within communities and the money is within communities, then we find that like we're more able to sustain ourselves and more able to thrive together. That was the first part of your question, but I've missed the second part. So please ask it again.
I think you've answered my question. It was just about, if we're saying that capitalism is the reason why we're in the situation that we're in when it comes to climate injustice, then what are the solutions here? Because it seems historically that communism, socialism and many other systems haven't really worked. That was my question. I think you answered it, unless you had something else to add.
Oh, I do, actually. I actually do. I think the answer definitely is one, like about wealth distribution. Like, I think these like corporations and like private companies definitely do, because they're separate to the state in a way, like they can operate in any way that they want, as long as they have the capital to prove that they can afford to do what they do. They continue to exploit people and the land to operate in the ways that they do, for one. Two, they can also pay off countries and governments to allow them to continue to pollute the way that they do. So like we see, like, even the UK, for example, will buy someone else's carbon footprint. For example, maybe somewhere like the country of Myanmar, which probably has a lower carbon footprint, it will buy their carbon footprint so they can pollute more. So there's ways around.
Can you explain that?
Yes, I can. So there's set by like the COP or Conference of the Parties, which is like the big climate conference, we have something that's called a carbon footprint. And the carbon footprint is essentially how much carbon dioxide your country, is done by countries and sometimes by region, your country emits. And for each person, there is a level. I'm not too sure on what the level actually is, but let's say it's 30 grams per meter squared, I don't know. And essentially, when you reach that limit, you're not meant to pollute anymore, which is, of course, impossible. And like, because countries kind of emit carbon dioxide at different rates. So America, for example, has one of the highest carbon footprints. And that's because the majority of people, compared to other places in the world, have a lot more amenities to pollute. They have cars, they use a lot of energy basically on all sorts of things, whereas countries that don't use as much will have lower carbon footprints. And what you can do when you're a richer country is essentially buy their like carbon footprint tokens. So it's like, even if you reach your level, you can buy, let's say, Ghana's carbon footprint. If they've only like used 3 of their measurements, they've essentially got 27 you can buy off them. So what that means is that these countries can continue to pollute because they can afford to continue to pollute, if that makes sense. So what we find with like governments and corporations and private businesses is that there's always a way, because they have the capital to afford to make a leeway. Even when we try to hold these corporations to account on environmental laws, they will pay an environmental lawyer to get them out of the loopholes. It took 20 years for Shell to be fined for what they did in the Ogoni land of Nigeria. And that was 20 years after the activists were killed. And they jumped through so many policy and law loopholes because they could afford to find the best lawyer to do that for them. So it's like, I think it does start with that. It starts with us as people and as the state to hold these corporations to account, because if we don't do that, who is going to do that when they're operating in such unsustainable ways? I also think it's about working towards a society where we value things as a common good. And by things, I mean like housing and roads and schools and transport, or like education. Also like access to healthcare and access to any food and water and energy. Once we place those in public good rather than in private good, because many of these amenities or like necessities are actually owned by private companies. Once we bring that into a community or common good, then we'll begin to see that more people are able to afford it and actually access it. So that's another thing. And then like the final thing I want to say is that capitalism kind of dictates that those with the most capital and wealth and power are those most quote unquote capable of deciding our solutions. And it means that like many of the top-down climate solutions, and that's a problem, I feel like with climate justice, there's a big emphasis on grassroots or from the bottom solutions upwards rather than the top down, because with top down climate solutions, they're often like colonialism continuing. There are many billionaires that are philanthropists, and like, what is philanthropy if not colonialism preserving? Like, it's a way for the West to dominate and control Black, Indigenous people of color in the global South, including farmers, for example, for profit. And we need to be looking beyond the veil of these top-down initiatives and these philanthropy initiatives, especially by leaders of corporations. Like, a big example is Bill Gates. For gender inequality in Africa, he was like, in order to tackle gender inequality, women need to have phones. And like on a surface level, it's like, do you know what? Yeah, true. Women do need to have phones to like call the people that they need to, construct their businesses by themselves and give them that independence. But what you don't know is that the company that he was promoting, he has massive investments in that company. So it means that by the women getting all of these phones from this company he's recommending, he's essentially paying himself. And it's quite often these are neo-colonial projects that leave a small minority benefiting off the large market and the destruction of people and land in the global South. And it's like, Bill Gates has enough money. Why is he still trying to pay himself from these same kind of models? So it's like, again, like capitalism isn't conducive to centering people and care in our climate and social justice solutions, nor is it in our society. So we do need to move away from something that is so hell-bent on profits rather than people.
Okay, well, I guess based on all you've said, my final question, because you know how we talked about the agency of the moon, I was wondering about the agency of people in Britain and Black women in Britain, because it seems that, as you suggest, there are lots of things up against us. So how do we, as people in Britain, as Black women in Britain, fight for climate justice? How do you do it? What are your tips?
Such a good question. I think for Black women, like, I think it's so important to center like care and community building. As you said, there is so much against us, and quite often Black women are the people looking out for Black women in such kind of fervent ways, like in such aggressive and beautiful ways. And like an example I can bring up that isn't a British example is like the Ogoni movement in the 80s. There was actually a women's version of, or not even a women's version, a women's sect called the Women Organizing Against Ogoni, or WASOP. And they essentially like did so many things. So whilst on marches, they had like people, members essentially like looking out for people's children. They constructed like education lessons around not only what Shell was doing was bad, but also teaching women like a different skill, or giving them the education to kind of live independently. They also had members across Nigeria and also across like the UK, Canada and the US who would like contribute funds and money to make sure that the women got what they needed. And I think we Black women in the UK can follow a similar-ish model where it's like, how are we creating these spaces for ourselves and our children and our loved ones to thrive and to eat and to provide shelter for each other? So it's like, if you know someone, for example, there are loads of us that still have family members and friends who are migrants. It's like, are you able to provide space in your homes for them to live there? Are you able to feed people in your community, not just like as in your family and friends, but like your actual community? Who do you know that needs help with childcare? I think those are some of the ways that we can extend our love and care for each other. I also think that Black women can get more, like they can be involved in like direct action. There's definitely things at stake especially the police. Like, we don't, black women are often kind of the back pedal of like police brutality. Black men are often centered in that kind of conversation, but black women do face a lot of violence from the police as well. I think, like, if you're interested in getting involved in direct action, please do. And it doesn't necessarily have to be you that's like strapping yourself to the plane, if you're not comfortable with that, of course. I think it's about like, how do you support other campaigners to do that? Maybe you could be the person that figures out the logistics, how people, where people are going to stay, where people are going to eat, kind of working around the campaigns planning of that, or the diet, and making sure that people are aware of the risks and the police and all sorts that they could face. You could also use other skills, like if you're a lawyer, for example, you could be the person that like takes on that case for them. I think there's so many ways that black women can get involved. If you're like a housing activist, you can continue to push sustainable homes that can withstand the kind of increasing extreme weather we're seeing here in the UK, and can advocate for like black people to, and especially black women to have homes. Like, black people experience some of the highest rates of like homelessness, both on couch surfing, but also being in the street. So it's like,
how in the UK?
Yeah. So it's like, how are we facilitating those spaces, or advocating for other black women and other black people in those spaces? I think maybe the final thing that I can think of that black women can do to sort of like get involved is kind of see like what campaign groups you kind of resonate with. There are quite a few POC-led climate groups. Like, a lot of them are in London, but there are some in cities and other areas in the UK. So like, there's black and green in Bristol. They're brilliant. You can join them. Or I know there's like the Wretched of the Earth in London. I'm not too sure if they're taking on other members, but they're definitely one to like support and campaign with. You've also got like divestment groups, which not all of them are POC led, but you know, they're groups that you can join and just begin sort of learning about climate justice, and give yourself the space to organize with other people and like learn in those spaces. Because like, no one is born a campaigner, but we all learn together and we're all trying together.
Thank you. That's all so, so helpful. And thank you so much for being on the podcast as well. I know that there are some people out there who will have agreed with everything you said. I know that some people will agree with some of what you said, and some people who will disagree with everything that you said. But thank you so much for coming, because I really, really appreciate your perspective. And I thought your tips were really, really helpful. And I'm sure that many, many people will take them on board. Simone, where can people follow you if they want to get more of this amazing thoughtfulness?
Oh my gosh. First of all, I want to say like, thank you so much for having me on. Like, this was one of the most beautiful podcasts I've been on, and like, your questions were just so insightful and beautiful. So I want to say thank you and big up you. You can find me at Simone Ahiyaku. I know it's super boring, but Simone Ahiyaku on Twitter, on Instagram. I don't use Facebook, but that's my name on Facebook. I don't use LinkedIn either, but that's the same name on LinkedIn. Yeah, so find me on Twitter and Instagram, basically.
Thank you. And what can we look out for next from you? Because if listeners don't know, Simone was recently featured on Stella McCartney's Instagram. So she's swimming with the big dogs. What are we looking forward to you coming up?
That gassery, my head is big. What you can look forward to from me next is, I'm actually, two things are coming up. I may be facilitating like a community initiative in Hackney. Hackney's basically trying to come up with community solutions for the area, such as like air quality, climate change, food sustainability. So I'll be facilitating that. So if anyone is in Hackney, like, please do come to that. Like, it's going to be a session for particularly what you want Hackney Council to be doing for you. The second thing is, in October, I'm working with the University of London on their programme. They have a 6-part programme called Entangled Futures, where they're getting together activists, politicians, artists, academics together to kind of figure out some climate solutions. And my date is like the 16th of October. There will be promo for that like closer to the time, but watch out for that. And I feel like I get called to do things at very random times. So if you see me before that, you can go on my Instagram, and I will always try and promote it prior to that, so you can catch anything that happens there.
That is awesome. So thank you so much, Simone, again. And we'll look forward to seeing what you do next.
Thank you so much. Take care. Thank you.